As if driving a spike with his hand, Fred Marshall bangs his fist down onto the desk. My son was gone for 4 hours before anyone noticed his bike. Now it's almost 7:30. He's been missing for most of the day. I shouldn't be sitting here. I should be driving around looking for him. Everybody's looking for your son, Fred, Dale says. My guys, the Stadies, even the FBI. I have no faith in them, Fred says. They haven't found Irma Freneau, have they? Why should they find my son? As far as I can see, I've got one chance here. When he looks at Jack, emotion turns his eyes into lamps. That chance is you, Lieutenant. Will you help me? Jack's third and most troubling thought, withheld until now and purely that of an experienced policeman, causes him to say, I'd like to talk to your wife. If you're planning on visiting her tomorrow, would you mind if I came along? Dale blinks and says, maybe we should talk about this. Do you think it would do some good? It might, Jack says. Seeing you might do her some good anyhow, Fred says. Don't you live in Norway Valley? That's on the way to Arden. I can pick you up about 9. Jack, Dale says. See you at 9, Jack says, ignoring the signals of mingled distress and anger emanating from his friend, also the little voice that whispers Feather. Amazing, says Henry Layden. I don't know whether to thank you or congratulate you. Both, I suppose. It's too late in the game to make bitch rod like me, but I think you could have a shot at dope. Don't lose your head. The only reason I went down there was to keep the boy's father from coming to my house. That wasn't the only reason. You're right. I was feeling sort of edgy and hemmed in. I felt like getting out, changing the scenery. But there was also another reason. Henry, you are hip-deep in pig shit, do you know that? You want to think I acted out of civic duty or honor or compassion or altruism or something, but I didn't. I don't like having to say this, but I'm a lot less good-hearted and responsible than you think I am. Hip-deep in pig shit? Man, you are absolutely on the money. I have been hip-deep in pig shit, not to mention chest-deep and even chin-deep in pig shit most of my life. Nice of you to admit it. However, you misunderstand me. You're right, I do think you're a good, decent person. I don't just think it, I know it. You're modest, you're compassionate, you're honorable, you're responsible, no matter what you think of yourself right now. But that wasn't what I was talking about. What did you mean, then? The other reason you decided to go to the police station is connected to this problem, this concern, whatever it is, that's been bugging you for the past couple of weeks. It's like you've been walking around under a shadow. Huh, Jack said. This problem, this secret of yours, takes up half your attention, so you're only half present. The rest of you is somewhere else. Sweetie, don't you think I can tell when you're worried and preoccupied? I might be blind, but I can see. Okay, let's suppose that something has been on my mind lately. What could that have to do with going to the station house? There are two possibilities. Either you were going off to confront it, or you were fleeing from it. Jack does not speak. All of which suggests that this problem has to do with your life as a policeman. It could be some old case coming back to haunt you. Maybe a psychotic thug you put in jail was released and is threatening to kill you. Or, hell, I'm completely full of shit, and you found out you have liver cancer and a life expectancy of 3 months. I don't have cancer, at least as far as I know, and no ex-con wants to kill me. All of my old cases, most of them anyway, are safely asleep in the records warehouse of the LAPD. Of course, something has been bothering me lately, and I should have expected you to see that. But I didn't want to, I don't know, burden you with it until I managed to figure it out for myself. Tell me one thing, will you? Were you going toward it or running away? There's no answer to that question. We shall see. Isn't the food ready by now? I'm starving, literally starving. You cook too slow. I would have been done 10 minutes ago. Hold your horses, Jack says. Coming right up, the problem is this crazy kitchen of yours. Most rational kitchen in America, maybe in the world. After ducking out of the police station quickly enough to avoid a useless conversation with Dale, Jack had yielded to impulse and called Henry with the offer of making dinner for both of them. A couple of good steaks, a nice bottle of wine, grilled mushrooms, a big salad. He could pick up everything they needed in French Landing. Jack had cooked for Henry on three or four previous occasions, and Henry had prepared one stupendously bizarre dinner for Jack. The housekeeper had taken all the herbs and spices off their rack to wash it, and she had put everything back in the wrong place. What was he doing in French Landing? He'd explained that when he got there. At 8:30, he had pulled up before Henry's roomy white farmhouse, greeted Henry and carried the groceries and his copy of Bleak House into the kitchen. He had tossed the book to the far end of the table, opened the wine, poured a glass for his host and one for himself, and started cooking. He'd had to spend several minutes reacquainting himself with the eccentricities of Henry's kitchen, in which objects were not located by kind, pans with pans, knives with knives, pots with pots, but according to what sort of meal required their usage. If Henry wanted to whip up a grilled trout and some new potatoes, he had only to open the proper cabinet to find all the necessary utensils. These were arranged in four basic groups, meat, fish, poultry, and vegetables, with many subgroups and sub-subgroups within each category. The filing system confounded Jack, who often had to peer into several widely separated realms before coming upon the frying pan or spatula he was looking for. As Jack chopped, wandered the shelves, and cooked, Henry had laid the table in the kitchen with plates and silverware and sat down to quiz his troubled friend. Now the steaks, rare, are transported to the plates, the mushrooms arrayed around them, and the enormous wooden salad bowl installed on the center of the table. Henry pronounces the meal delicious, takes a sip of his wine, and says, "If you still won't talk about your trouble, whatever it is, you'd better at least tell me what happened at the station." "I suppose there's very little doubt that another child was snatched." "Next to none, I'm sorry to say. It's a boy named Tyler Marshall. His father's name is Fred Marshall, and he works out at Goltz's. Do you know him?" "Been a long time since I bought a combine," Henry says. "The first thing that struck me was that Fred Marshall was a very nice guy," Jack says, and goes on to recount in great detail and leaving nothing out the evening's events and revelations, except for one matter, that of his third, his unspoken thought. "You actually asked to visit Marshall's wife? In the mental wing at French County Lutheran?" "Yes, I did," Jack says. "I'm going there tomorrow." "I don't get it." Henry eats by hunting the food with his knife, spearing it with his fork, and measuring off a narrow strip of steak. "Why would you want to see the mother?" "Because one way or another I think she's involved," Jack says. "Oh, come off it. The boy's own mother?" "I'm not saying she's the fisherman, because of course she isn't. But according to her husband, Judy Marshall's behavior started to change before Amy St. Pierre disappeared. She got worse and worse as the murders went on, and on the day her son vanished, she flipped out completely. Her husband had to have her committed." "Wouldn't you say she had an excellent reason to break down?" "She flipped out before anyone told her about her son. Her husband thinks she has ESP. He said she saw the murders in advance, she knew the fisherman was on the way, and she knew her son was gone before they found the bike. When Fred Marshall came home, he found her tearing at the walls and talking nonsense, completely out of control." "You hear about lots of cases where a mother is suddenly aware of some threat or injury to her child, a psychic bond. Sounds like mumbo-jumbo, but I guess it happens." "I don't believe in ESP, and I don't believe in coincidence." "So what are you saying?" "Judy Marshall knows something, and whatever she knows is a real showstopper. Fred can't see it, he's much too close, and Dale can't see it either. You should have heard him talk about her." "So what is she supposed to know?" "I think she may know the doer. I think it has to be someone close to her. Whoever he is, she knows his name, and it's driving her crazy." Henry frowns and uses his inchworm technique to entrap another piece of steak. "So you're going to the hospital to open her up," he finally says. "Yes, basically." A mysterious silence follows this statement. Henry quietly whittles away at the meat, chews what he whittles, and washes it down with Jordan Cabernet. How did your DJ gig go? Was it okay? It was a thing of beauty. All the adorable old swingers cut loose on the dance floor, even the ones in wheelchairs. One guy sort of rubbed me the wrong way. He was rude to a woman named Alice, and he asked me to play Lady McGowan's Nightmare, which doesn't exist, as you probably know. It's Lady McGowan's Dream, Woody Herman. Good boy. The thing was, he had this terrible voice. It sounded like something out of hell. Anyhow, I didn't have a Woody Herman record, and he asked for the Bunny Berrigan I Can't Get Started, which happened to be Rhoda's favorite record. What with my goofy ear hallucinations and all, it shook me up. I don't know why. For a few minutes, they concentrate on their plates. Jack says, "What do you think, Henry?" Henry tilts his head, auditing an inner voice. Scowling, he sets down his fork. The inner voice continues to demand his attention. He adjusts his shades and faces Jack. "In spite of everything you say, you still think like a cop." Jack bridles at the suspicion that Henry is not paying him a compliment. "What do you mean by that?" "Cops see differently than people who aren't cops. When a cop looks at someone, he wonders what he's guilty of. The possibility of innocence never enters his mind. To a long-time cop, a guy who's put in 10 years or more, everyone who isn't a cop is guilty. Only most of them haven't been caught yet." Henry has described the mindset of dozens of men Jack once worked with. "Henry, how do you know about that?" "I can see it in their eyes," Henry says. "That's the way policemen approach the world. You are a policeman." Jack blurts out, "I am a coppersman." Appalled, he blushes. "Sorry. That stupid phrase has been running around and around in my head, and it just popped out." "Why don't we clear the dishes and start on Bleak House?" When their few dishes have been stacked beside the sink, Jack takes the book from the far side of the table and follows Henry toward the living room, pausing on the way to glance, as he always does, at his friend's studio. A door with a large glass insert opens into a small, soundproof chamber, bristling with electronic equipment. The microphone and turntable back from Maxton's and reinstalled before Henry's well-padded swiveling chair, a disc changer and matching digital-analog converter mount close at hand, beside a mixing board and a massive tape recorder adjacent to the other, larger window, which looks into the kitchen. When Henry had been planning the studio, Rhoda requested the windows because she'd said she wanted to be able to see him at work. There isn't a wire in sight. The entire studio has the disciplined neatness of the captain's quarters on a ship. "Looks like you're going to work tonight," Jack says. "I want to get 2 more Henry shakes ready to send, and I'm working on something for a birthday salute to Lester Young and Charlie Parker." "Were they born on the same day?" "Close enough. August 27th and 29th. You know, I can't quite tell if you'll want the lights on or not." "Let's turn them on," Jack says. And so Henry Layden switches on the 2 lamps beside the window, and Jack Sawyer moves to the overstuffed chair near the fireplace and turns on the tall lamp at one of its rounded arms and watches as his friend walks unerringly to the light just inside the front door and the ornate fixture alongside his own, his favorite resting place, the mission-style sofa, clicking first one, then the other into life, then settles down onto the sofa with one leg stretched out along its length. Even low light pervades the long room and swells into greater brightness around Jack's chair. "Bleak House by Charles Dickens," he says. He clears his throat. "Okay, Henry, we're off to the races. London, Michaelmas term lately over," he reads, and marches into a world made of soot and mud. Muddy dogs, muddy horses, muddy people, a day without light. Soon he has reached the second paragraph. "Fog everywhere. Fog up the river, where it flows among green eights and meadows. Fog down the river, where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes, fog on the Kentish heights. Fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs, fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships. Fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats. His voice catches, and his mind temporarily drifts off focus. What he is reading unhappily reminds him of French Landing, of Sumner Street and Chase Street, of the lights in the window of the Oak Tree Inn, the Thunder Five lurking in Nail House Row, and the gray ascent from the river, of Queen Street and Maxton's Hedges, the little houses spreading out on grids, all of it choked by unseen fog, which engulfs a battered no-trespassing sign on the highway and swallows the sandbar and glides hungry and searching down the valleys. "Sorry," he said. "I was just thinking."
"I was too," Henry says.
"Go on, please." But for that brief flicker of an old no-trespassing sign, completely unaware of the black house he one day will have to enter, Jack concentrates again on the page and continues reading Bleak House. The windows darken as the lamps grow warmer. The case of Jarndyce and Jarndyce grinds through the courts, aided or impeded by attorneys Chisel, Mizzle, and Drizzle. Lady Dedlock leaves Sir Leicester Dedlock alone at their great estate with its moldy chapel, stagnant river, and ghost's walk. Esther Summerson begins to chirp away in the first person. Our friends decide that the appearance of Esther demands a small libation if they are to get through much more chirping. Henry unfolds from the sofa, sails into the kitchen, and returns with two short, fat glasses, one-third filled with Balvini Doublewood single malt whiskey, as well as a glass of plain water for the reader. A couple of sips, a few murmurs of appreciation, and Jack resumes. Esther, Esther, Esther. But beneath the water torture of her relentless sunniness, the story gathers steam and carries both reader and listener along in its train. Having come to a convenient stopping point, Jack closes the book and yawns. Henry stands up and stretches. They move to the door, and Henry follows Jack outside, beneath a vast night sky brilliantly scattered with stars.
"Tell me one thing," Henry says.
"Shoot.
When you were in the station house, did you really feel like a cop? Or did you feel like you were pretending to be one?"
"Actually, it was kind of surprising," Jack says. "In no time at all, I felt like a cop again."
"Good.
Why is that good?"
"Because it means you were running toward that mysterious secret, not away from it."
Shaking his head and smiling, deliberately not giving Henry the satisfaction of a reply, Jack steps up into his vehicle and says goodbye from the slight but distinct elevation of the driver's seat. The engine coughs and churns, his headlights snap into being, and Jack is on his way home. Chapter 9. Not many hours later, Jack finds himself walking down the midway of a deserted amusement park under a gray autumn sky. On either side of him are boarded-over concessions, the Fenway Frank's hot dog stand, the Annie Oakley shooting gallery, the Pitch Till You Win. Rain has fallen, and more is coming. The air is sharp with moisture. Not far away, he can hear the lonely thunder of waves hurling themselves against a deserted shingle of beach. From closer by comes the snappy sound of guitar picking. It should be cheerful, but to Jack, it is dread set to music. He shouldn't be here. This is an old place, a dangerous place. He passes a boarded-up ride. A sign out front reads, "The Speedy Apopanax will reopen Memorial Day 1982. See ya then." Apopanax, Jack thinks. Only he is no longer Jack. Now he's Jackie. He's Jackie Boy, and he and his mother are on the run. From whom? From Sloat, of course. From hustlin', bustlin' Uncle Morgan. Speedy, Jack thinks. And as if he is given a telepathic cue, a warm, slightly slurry voice begins to sing. When the red, red robin comes bob-bob-bobbin' along, there'll be no more sobbin' when he starts throbbin' his old sweet song. No, Jack thinks, I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear your old sweet song. You can't be here anyway. You're dead. Dead on the Santa Monica Pier. Old, bald, black man dead in the shadow of a frozen merry-go-round horse. Oh, but no. When the old cop logic comes back, it takes hold like a tumor, even in dreams. And it doesn't take much of it to realize that this isn't Santa Monica. It's too cold and too old. This is the land of ago, when Jackie and the Queen of the Bees fled out of California like the fugitives they had become. And didn't stop running until they got to the other coast, the place where Lily Cavanaugh Sawyer, no, I don't think of this, I never think of this, had come to die.
Wake up, you sleepyhead.
The voice of his old friend. Friend my ass, he's the one who put me on the road of trials, the one who came between me and Richard, my real friend. He's the one who almost got me killed, almost drove me crazy.
Wake up, get out of bed.
Wake up, wake up, wake up. Time to face the fearsome Apopanax. Time to get back to your not-so-sweet used-to-be. No, Jackie whispers, and then the midway ends. Ahead is the carousel, sort of like the one on the Santa Monica Pier, and sort of like the one he remembers from, well, from ago. It is a hybrid, in other words, a dream specialty, neither here nor there. But there's no mistaking the man who sits beneath one of the frozen, rearing horses with his guitar on his knee. Jackie Boy would know that face anywhere, and all the old love rises in his heart. He fights it, but that is a fight few people win, especially not those who have been turned back to the age of 12. Speedy, he cries. The old man looks at him and his brown face cracks open in a smile.
"Travel in, Jack," he says. "How I have missed you, son."
"I've missed you too," he says. "But I don't travel anymore. I've settled down in Wisconsin. This," he gestures at his magically restored boy's body, clad in jeans and a t-shirt, "this is just a dream."
"Maybe so. Maybe not. In any case, you got a mite more traveling to do, Jack. I've been telling you that for some time."
"What do you mean?" Speedy's grin is sly in the middle, exasperated at the corners.
"Don't play the fool with me, Jackie. Sent you the feathers, didn't I? Sent you a robin's egg, didn't I? Sent you more'n one."
"Why can't people leave me alone?" Jack asks. His voice is suspiciously close to a whine, not a pretty sound. "You, Henry, Dale?"
"Quit on it now," Speedy says, growing stern. "Ain't got no more time to ask you nice. The game has gotten rough, ain't it?" "Speedy, you got your job and I got mine. Same job, too. Don't you whine at me, Jack, and don't make me chase you no more. You're a coppiceman, same as ever was."
"I'm retired."
"Shit on your retired. The kids he killed, that's bad enough. The kids he might kill if he's let go on, that's worse. But the one he's got..."
Speedy leans forward, dark eyes blazing in his dark face.
"That boy has got to be brought back, and soon. If you can't get him back, you got to kill him yourself, little as I like to think of it. Because he's a breaker, a powerful one. One more might be all he needs to take it down."
"Who might need?" Jack asks.
"The Crimson King."
"And what is it this Crimson King wants to take down?" Speedy looks at him a moment, then starts to play that perky tune again instead of answering. There'll be no more sobbing when he starts throbbing his old sweet song.
"Speedy, I can't."
The tune ends in a discordant jangle of strings. Speedy looks at 12-year-old Jack Sawyer with a coldness that chills the boy inward all the way to the hidden man's heart. And when he speaks again, Speedy Parker's faint southern accent has deepened. It has filled with a contempt that is almost liquid.
You get busy now, hear me? Y'all quit whining and crying and slacking off. Y'all pick up your guts from wherever you left them and get busy.
Jack steps back. A heavy hand falls on his shoulder, and he thinks it's Uncle Morgan, him, or maybe Sunlight Gardner. It's 1981, and I've got to do it all over again. But that is a boy's thought, and this is a man's dream. Jack Sawyer, as he is now, thrusts the child's acquiescing despair away. No, not at all. I deny that. I have put those faces and those places aside. It was hard work, and I won't see it all undone by a few phantom feathers, a few phantom eggs, and one bad dream. Find yourself another boy, Speedy. This one grew up. He turns, ready to fight, but no one's there. Lying behind him on the boardwalk on its side like a dead pony is a boy's bicycle. There's a license plate on the back reading Big Mac. Scattered around it are shiny crow's feathers. And now Jack hears another voice, cold and cracked, ugly and unmistakably evil. He knows it's the voice of the thing that touched him.
That's right, asswipe. Stay out of it. You mess with me and I'll strew your guts from Racine to La Riviere.
A spinning hole opens in the boardwalk just in front of the bike. It widens like a startled eye. It continues to widen, and Jack dives for it. It's the way back, the way out. The contemptuous voice follows him.
That's right, Jackoff, it says. Run! Run from the Abala! Run from the king! Run for your miserable fucking life!
The voice dissolves into laughter, and it is the mad sound of that laughter which follows Jack Sawyer down into the darkness between worlds. Hours later, Jack stands naked at his bedroom window, absently scratching his ass and watching the sky lighten in the east. He's been awake since 4. He can't remember much of his dream. His defenses may be bending, but even now they have not quite broken. Yet enough of it lingers for him to be sure of one thing. The corpse on the Santa Monica Pier upset him so badly that he quit his job because it reminded him of someone he once knew. All of that never happened, he tells the coming day in a falsely patient voice. I had a kind of pre-adolescent breakdown brought on by stress. My mother thought she had cancer, she grabbed me, and we ran all the way to the East Coast, all the way to New Hampshire. She thought she was going back to the great happy place to die. Turned out to be mostly vapor, some goddamn actress midlife crisis. But what does a kid know? I was stressed. I had dreams. Jack sighs. I dreamed I saved my mother's life. The phone behind him rings, the sound shrill and broken in the shadowy room. Jack Sawyer screams. I woke you up, Fred Marshall says. And Jack knows at once that this man has been up all night, sitting in his wifeless, sunless home, looking at photo albums, perhaps, while the TV plays, knowing he is rubbing salt into the wounds, but unable to quit. No, Jack says. Actually, I was... He stops. The phone's beside the bed, and there's a pad beside the phone. There's a note written on the pad. Jack must have written it, since he's the only one here, Ella fucking Mentory, my dear Watson, but it isn't in his handwriting. At some point in his dream, he wrote this note in his dead mother's handwriting. The tower, the beams, if the beams are broken, Jackie boy, if the beams are broken and the tower falls, there's no more. There is only poor old Fred Marshall, who has discovered how quickly things can go bad in the sunniest Midwestern life. Jack's mouth has attempted to say a couple of things while his mind is occupied with this forgery from his subconscious, probably not very sensible things, but that doesn't bother Fred. He simply goes droning along with none of the stops and drops that folks usually employ to indicate the ends of sentences or changes of thought. Fred is just getting it out, unloading. And even in his own distressed state, Jack realizes that Fred Marshall of 16 Robin Hood Lane, that sweet little Cape Cod honey of a home, is nearing the edge of his endurance. If things don't turn around for him soon, he won't need to visit his wife in Ward D of French County Lutheran. They'll be roommates. And it is their proposed visit to Judy of which Fred is speaking, Jack realizes. He quits trying to interrupt and simply listens, frowning down at the note he has written to himself as he does so. Tower and beams? What kind of beams? Sunbeams? Horn beams? Raise high the roof beam carpenters? No, I said I'd pick you up at 9, but Dr. Spiegelman, that's her doctor up there, Spiegelman his name is, he said she had a very bad night with a lot of yelling and screaming and then trying to get up the wallpaper and eat it and maybe a seizure of some kind. So they're trying to run a new medication he might have, said Pamazine or Patazone. I didn't write it down. Spiegelman called me 15 minutes ago. I wonder if those guys ever sleep. And said we should be able to see her around 4. He thinks she'll be more stabilized by 4. And we could see her then, so I could pick you up at 3, or maybe you have 3. Would be fine, Jack says quietly. Other stuff to do, other plans, I'd understand that, but I could come by if you don't. It's mostly that I don't want to go alone. I'll be waiting for you, Jack said. We'll go in my pickup. Thought maybe I'd hear from Ty or from whoever snatched him, like maybe a ransom demand, but no one called, only Spiegelman. He's my wife's doctor up there at Fred. I'm going to find your boy. Jack is appalled at this bald assurance, at the suicidal confidence he hears in his own voice. But it serves at least one purpose, bringing Fred's flood of dead words to an end. There is blessed silence from the other end of the line. At last Fred speaks in a trembling whisper.
Oh, sir, if I could only believe that.
I want you to try, Jack says. And maybe we can find your wife's mind while we're at it. Maybe both are in the same place, he thinks, but this he does not say. Liquid sounds come from the other end of the line. Fred has begun to cry. Fred.
Yes?
You're coming to my place at 3.
Yes.
A mighty sniff, a miserable cry that is mostly choked back. Jack has some comprehension of how empty Fred Marshall's house must feel at this moment, and even that dim understanding is bad enough. My place in Norway Valley. Come past Roy's store over Tamarack Creek. I know where it is. A faint edge of impatience has crept into Fred's voice. Jack is very glad to hear it. Good, I'll see you.
You bet.
Jack hears a ghost of Fred's salesman cheer, and it twists his heart. What time?
3?
Then, with marginal assurance,
3.
That's right. We'll take my truck. Maybe we'll have a bite of supper at Gertie's kitchen on our way back. Goodbye, Fred.
Goodbye, sir, and thank you.
Jack hangs up the phone. Looks a moment longer at his memory's reproduction of his mother's handwriting, and wonders what you'd call such a thing in cop speak. Auto forgery? He snorts, then crumples the note up and starts getting dressed. He will drink a glass of juice, then go out walking for an hour or so, blow all the bad dreams out of his head, and blow away the sound of Fred Marshall's awful, droning voice while he's at it. Then, after a shower, he might or might not call Dale Gilbertson and ask if there have been any developments. If he's really going to get involved in this, there'll be a lot of paperwork to catch up on. He'll want to re-interview the parents, take a look at the old folks' home close to where the Marshall kid disappeared. With his mind full of such thoughts, pleasant thoughts, actually, although if this had been suggested to him, he would have strenuously denied it, Jack almost stumbles over the box sitting on the welcome mat just outside his front door. It's where Buck Evitz, the postman, leaves packages when he has packages to leave. But it's not gone 6:30 yet, and Buck won't be along in his little blue truck for another 3 hours. Jack bends down and cautiously picks the package up. It's the size of a shoebox covered with brown paper that has been cut raggedly and secured not with tape, but big drools of red sealing wax. In addition to this, there are complicated loops of white string secured with a child's oversized bow. There's a cluster of stamps in the upper corner, 10 or a dozen, featuring various birds. No robins, however. Jack notes this with understandable relief. There's something not right about those stamps, but at first Jack doesn't see what it is. He's too focused on the address, which is spectacularly not right. There's no box number, no RFD number, no zip code, no name, not really. The address consists of a single word, scrawled in large capital letters. Jackie. Looking at those bedraggled letters, Jack imagines a fisted hand clutching a Sharpie marker, narrowed eyes, a tongue poked from the corner of some lunatic's mouth. His heartbeat has sped up to double time. "I'm not liking this," he breathes. "I am so not liking this." And, of course, there are perfectly good reasons, coppiceman reasons, not to. It is a shoebox. He can feel the edge of the top right through the brown paper, and nutters have been known to put bombs in shoeboxes. He'd be crazy to open it, but he has an idea he will open it just the same. If it blows him sky high, at least he'll be able to opt out of the fisherman investigation. Jack raises the package to listen for ticking, fully aware that ticking bombs are as out of date as Betty Boop cartoons. He hears nothing, but he does see what's wrong with the stamps, which aren't stamps at all. Someone has carefully cut the front panels from a dozen or so cafeteria sugar packets and taped them to this wrapped shoebox. A grunt of humorless laughter escapes Jack. Some nut sent him this, all right. Some nut in a locked facility with easier access to sugar packets than to stamps. But how has it gotten here? Who left it with the fake stamps uncancelled while he was dreaming his confused dreams? And who in this part of the world could possibly know him as Jackie? His Jackie days are long gone.
"No, they ain't traveling, Jack," a voice whispers. "Not by half. Time to stop your sobbing and get bobbing along, boy. Start by seeing what's in that box."
Resolutely ignoring his own mental voice, which tells him he's being dangerously stupid, Jack snaps the twine and uses his thumbnail to cut through the sloppy blobs of red wax. Who uses sealing wax in this day and age, anyway? He sets the wrapping paper aside. Something else for the forensics boys, maybe. It isn't a shoebox, but a sneaker box. A New Balance sneaker box, to be exact. Size 5, a child's size. And at that, Jack's heart speeds up to triple time. He feels beads of cold sweat springing up on his forehead. His gorge and sphincter are both tightening up. This is also familiar. It is how coppice men get cocked and locked, ready to look at something awful. And this will be awful. Jack has no doubt about it, and no doubt about who the package is from. "This is my last chance to back out," he thinks. "After this, it's all aboard and hey-ho for the wherever." But even that is a lie, he realizes. Dale will be looking for him at the police station on Sumner Street by noon. Fred Marshall is coming to Jack's place at 3 o'clock, and they're going to see the mad housewife of Robin Hood Lane. The back-out point has already come and gone. Jack still isn't sure how it happened, but it looks like he's back in harness. And if Henry Layden has the temerity to congratulate him on this, Jack thinks, he'll probably kick Henry's blind ass for him. A voice from his dream whispers up from beneath the floorboards of Jack's consciousness like a whiff of rotten air. "I'll strew your guts from Racine to La Riviere!" But this bothers him less than the madness inherent in the sugar-pack stamps and the laboriously printed letters of his old nickname. He has dealt with crazies before, not to mention his share of threats. He sits down on the steps with the sneaker box on his thighs. Beyond him, in the north field, all is still and gray. Bunny Betcher, son of Tom Tom, came and did the second cutting only a week ago, and now a fine mist hangs above the ankle-high stubble. Above it, the sky has just begun to brighten. Not a single cloud as yet marks its calm, no color. Somewhere a bird calls out. Jack breathes deeply and thinks, if this is where I go out, I could do worse. A lot worse. Then, very carefully, he takes the lid off the box and sets it aside. Nothing explodes. but it looks as if someone has filled the New Balance sneaker box with night. Then he realizes that it's been packed away with shiny black crow feathers, and his arms roughen with goosebumps. He reaches toward them, then hesitates. He wants to touch those feathers about as much as he'd want to touch the corpse of a half-decayed plague victim, but there's something beneath them. He can see it. Should he get some gloves? There are gloves in the front hall closet. Fuck the gloves, Jack says, and dumps the box onto the brown paper wrapping lying beside him on the porch. There's a flood of feathers, which swirl a bit even in the perfectly still morning air. Then a thump, as the object around which the feathers were packed, lands on Jack's porch. The smell hits Jack's nose a moment later, an odor like rotting bologna. Someone has delivered a child's blood-stained sneaker Shea Sawyer on Norway Valley Road. Something has gnawed at it pretty briskly, and even more briskly at what's inside it. He sees a lining of bloody white cotton. That would be a sock. And inside the sock, tatters of skin. This is a child's New Balance sneaker with a child's foot inside it, one that has been badly used by some animal. He sent it, Jack thinks. The fisherman. Taunting him. Telling him, if you want in, come on in. The water's fine, Jackie boy. The water is fine. Jack gets up. His heart is hammering, the beats now too close together to count. The beads of sweat on his forehead have swelled and broken and gone running down his face like tears. His lips and hands and feet are numb, yet he tells himself he is calm. That he has seen worse, much worse, piled up against bridge abutments and freeway underpasses in L.A. Nor is this his first severed body part. Once, in 1997, he and his partner Kirby Tessier found a single testicle sitting on top of a toilet tank in the Culver City Public Library like an ancient soft-boiled egg. So he tells himself he is calm. He gets up and walks down the porch steps. He walks past the hood of his burgundy-colored Dodge Ram with a world-class sound system inside. He walks past the Bird Hotel he and Dale put up at the edge of the North Field a month or two after Jack moved into this, the most perfect house in the universe. He tells himself he is calm. He tells himself that it's evidence. That's all. Just one more loop in the hangman's noose that the fisherman will eventually put around his own neck. He tells himself not to think of it as part of a kid, part of a little girl named Irma, but as Exhibit A. He can feel dew wetting his sockless ankles and the cuffs of his pants, knows that any sort of extended stroll through the hay stubble is going to ruin a $500 pair of Gucci loafers. And so what if it does? He's rich well beyond the point of vulgarity. He can have as many shoes as Imelda Marcos if he wants. The important thing is, he's calm. Someone brought him a shoebox with a human foot inside it, laid it on his porch in the dark of night, but he's calm. It's evidence, that's all. And he is a coppiceman. Evidence is his meat and drink. He just needs to get a little air, needs to clear his nose of the rotted bologna smell that came puffing out of the box. Jack makes a strangled, gagging, irking sound, and begins to hurry on a little faster. There is a sense of approaching climax growing in his mind, my calm mind, he tells himself. Something is getting ready to break, or change back. That last idea is particularly alarming, and Jack begins to run across the field, knees lifting higher, arms pumping. His passage draws a dark line through the stubble, a diagonal that starts at the driveway and might end anywhere. Canada, maybe. Or the North Pole. White moths, started out of their dew-heavy morning doze, flutter up in lacy swirls, and then slump back into the cut stubble. He runs faster, away from the chewed and bloody sneaker lying on the porch of the perfect house, away from his own horror. But that sense of coming climax stays with him. Faces begin to rise in his mind, each with its own accompanying snippet of soundtrack. Faces and voices he has ignored for 20 years or more. When these faces rise or those voices mutter, he has until now told himself the old lie, that once there was a frightened boy who caught his mother's neurotic terror like a cold and made up a story, a grand fantasy with good old mom-saving Jack Sawyer at its center. None of it was real, and it was forgotten by the time he was 16. By then, he was calm. Just as he's calm now, running across his north field like a lunatic, leaving that dark track and those clouds of startled moths behind him, but doing it calmly. Narrow face, narrow eyes under a tilted white paper cap. If you can run me out a keg when I need one, you can have the job. Smoky Updike from Oatley, New York, where they drank the beer and then ate the glass. Oatley, where there'd been something in the tunnel outside of town and where Smoky had kept him prisoner. Until, prying eyes, false smile, brilliant white suit, I've met you before, Jack. Where? Tell me. Confess. Sunlight Gardner, an Indiana preacher whose name had also been Osmond. Osmond in some other world. The broad, hairy face and frightened eyes of a boy who wasn't a boy at all. This is a bad place, Jackie. Wolf knows. And it was. It was a very bad place. They put him in a box, put good old Wolf in a box, and finally they killed him. Wolf died of a disease called America. Wolf, the running man in the field gasps. Wolf, ah, God, I'm sorry. Faces and voices, all those faces and voices, rising in front of his eyes, dinning into his ears, demanding to be seen and heard, filling him with that sense of climax, every defense on the verge of being washed away like a breakwater before a tidal wave. Nausea roars through him and tilts the world. He makes that irking sound again, and this time it fills the back of his throat with a taste he remembers, the taste of cheap, rough wine. And suddenly it's New Hampshire again, Arcadia Fun World again. He and Speedy are standing beside the carousel again, all those frozen horses. All carousel horses is named. Don't you know that, Jack? And Speedy is holding out a bottle of wine and telling him it's magic juice. One little sip, and he'll go over. Flip over. No, Jack cries, knowing it's already too late. I don't want to go over. The world tilts the other way, and he falls into the grass on his hands and knees with his eyes squeezed shut. He doesn't need to open them. The richer, deeper smells that suddenly fill his nose tell him everything he needs to know. That, and the sense of coming home after so many dark years, when almost every waking motion and decision has in some way been dedicated to canceling, or at least postponing, the arrival of this very moment. This is Jack Sawyer, ladies and gentlemen, down on his knees in a vast field of sweet grass, under a morning sky untainted by a single particle of pollution. He is weeping. He knows what has happened, and he is weeping. His heart bursts with fear and joy. This is Jack Sawyer, 20 years along, grown to be a man, and back in the territories again, at last. It is the voice of his old friend Richard, sometimes known as Rational Richard, that saves him. Richard as he is now, head of his own law firm, Slowden Associates Limited. Not Richard as he was when Jack perhaps knew him best, during long vacation days on Seabrook Island in South Carolina. The Richard of Seabrook Island had been imaginative, quick-spoken, fast on his feet, mop-topped, skinny as a morning shadow. The current Richard, corporate law Richard, is thinning on top, thick in the middle, much in favor of sitting and bushmills. Also, he has crushed his imagination, so brilliantly playful in those Seabrook Island days, like a troublesome fly. Richard Sloat's life has been one of reduction, Jack has sometimes thought. But one thing has been added, probably in law school. The pompous, sheep-like sound of hesitation, particularly annoying on the phone, which is now Richard's vocal signature. This sound starts with the lips closed, then opens out as Richard's lips spring wide, making him look like an absurd combination of Vienna choir boy and Lord Haw-Haw. Now, kneeling with his eyes shut in the vast green reach of what used to be his very own North Field, smelling the new, deeper smells that he remembers so well and has longed for so fiercely without even realizing it, Jack hears Richard Sloat begin speaking in the middle of his head. What a relief those words are. He knows it's only his own mind mimicking Richard's voice, but it's still wonderful. If Richard were here, Jack thinks he'd embrace his old friend and say, "May you pontificate forever, Richie boy, sheep bray and all." Rational Richard says, "You realize you're dreaming, Jack, don't you? The stress of opening that package, no doubt, no doubt caused you to pass out, and that in turn has caused the dream you're having now." Down on his knees, eyes still closed and hair hanging in his face, Jack says, "In other words, it's what we used to call..." "Correct! What we used to call Seabrook Island stuff. But Seabrook Island was a long time ago, Jack. So I suggest you open your eyes, get back on your feet, and remind yourself that should you see anything out of the ordinary, it's not really there." "Not really there," Jack murmurs. He stands up and opens his eyes. He knows from the very first look that it is really here, but he holds Richard's pompous "I look 35, but I'm really 60 voice in his head, shielding himself with it. Thus, he is able to maintain a precarious balance instead of passing out for real, or perhaps cracking up entirely.